Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am ACGS. My name is Roy, Romeo Oscar Yankee, and I am the control operator for the Limemark Technical Net. Limemark Technical Net has been going on for more than 44 years, and every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit ourselves in front of our radios and chat with each other and exchange information. We learn from each other, we teach each other, and hopefully we entertain each other. And I thank you all once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. Let me drop back in, and I will give you the usual links. If you would like to reach me via email, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. That would be for mail bastions. That's TechNet questions when you can't get to the TechNet on time. And also offering me a TechNet puzzle. We're always looking for technical puzzles to stimulate conversation. Or if you have an expertise in some technology that suddenly comes into the news and you'd like to share your insight with us, or you would like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to discuss some NASA space-related story that you saw a video, YouTube or such. Of course, you can reach him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, as always, I put up a link page with a bunch of interesting articles and or YouTubes that I've seen throughout the week. When I see them, I cut them, I paste them, and I put them in the link page. So you can avail yourself of it 24/7. Any old time, in the middle of the night, the page will always be available. We have a chat room. Sometimes it's busy, sometimes it's quiet. You get to it by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and that will take you to the chat room. We offer an audio stream on the Internet of the Technical Net, and we leave it on most of the week in case someone wants to listen in to Glen Oaks and they don't have a radio on them. So you can get there by typing into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. Also, I always like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It's been around for a long time now. It's had over a million visitors, and its Limemark TechNet archives go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who have either moved away from the area or unfortunately become silent over the years. So that's the link. Let me drop and I'll tell you what we got for tonight. Okay, nothing much special is going on with AI. When there are big news in AI, I like to spread it about. Everyone's kind of dreaming of their trillion-dollar profit margin. Anyway, we are going to have a regular session. We will ask questions, topics, comments, what have you. Hopefully the first few will be amateur radio-related because this is an amateur radio net, but we will try and deal with any science or technology that anyone can throw at us. So that should take us approximately to 10:15. Paul will join us for the SpaceNet report. That should take to about 11 o'clock, and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's our plan. If everything works the way it's supposed to and I don't get kicked off All-Star too many times. So let the show begin. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for tonight, again, preferably amateur radio related, but we'll take anything. Hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign and what manner of question it might be. You don't have to give me the actual question. Just if it's amateur radio related or if it's some non-amateur radio related question.
And to Exane, amateur related.
KT2VHD, one ham, one fake intelligence related.
Okay, Wes and Jim recognized. Anyone else out there want to put their name down? You know, sometimes we have these little problems of people, you know, arriving very late and then kind of wondering why they don't have the opportunity to make a comment or ask a question. Although we try our best to keep it open even to the very end of this segment of the Technical Net. But still, it's always nice if you come earlier rather than later. So with that in mind, if there's anyone else out there that wants to put a, go on the line, please feel free to hit that push to talk.
AD2DU.
Okay, Alex, you are recognized. You're on the list. Anyone else want to go on the list? Please feel free. Hit that push to talk. You're about 90% noise, unfortunately. So if there's any way that you can improve your signal to the repeater, go closer to the window, adjust the orientation of your handy talkie if you're on a handy talkie, raise the power to your base station if that's what you're doing, it can do, and try again.
This is Whiskey 2, Julia, top of mic. Can you hear me now? W2J.
I can just hear you. You're about maybe 80% noise now. So it's I could make you out. Is there any way you can boost it any more?
Whiskey 2 up on mic, but the first letter is not working.
Yeah, I was able to get his call sign, but, you know, with that much noise in the background, it'll probably not be the easiest conversation-wise. John, if you're going to try to boost your signal, give me a holler so I know to wait for you a little bit. If not, give me a holler the other way. Okay, we'll check in with John later on. Maybe he's doing something to boost his signal. Right now, he's not signaling at all. So we'll get back to you, John, later on. Once again, Wesley, you know what I'm going to ask you. And I'm sure, and I know what you're going to say, but we have to kind of do it just for formality's sake. Do you mind if I take Jim and Alex before you, Wes?
Absolutely not. Go ahead.
Okay, very good. Jim, what you got for us tonight?
You want the fake intelligence question or the dipole question first?
Okay, it's up to you. I leave the orders up to you.
Very good. KD2VHD, Jim. So the fake intelligence thing is, it's interesting how it's getting, even by folks who are excited to see it happen, getting the fisheye these days. But what's really wild is it's exploding all over advertising and YouTube and all this stuff. So many of the things that were done with, crude or creative methodologies for making videos, they're just all over the place. It's AI. It's crazy. From alligators in uniforms to people flying through space, it's like exploding and it's so easy to spot if you just take a minute and look at it and go, is that real? And you go, no, it's obviously not. Any comments on my observation?
Well, I agree with you. The more you look into almost any aspect of the world, the more you begin to notice this corrosion, this slop that we're being presented with. And we talked about this over a year ago, that it's gotten so bad that a lot of the AI software is still being fed through the internet, through websites and all kinds of stuff, and they're being regurgitated and fed back on their own slop, which is going to deteriorate their data and make them even more annoying than they are today. But Amazon has a lot of self-published books that are all AI slop. The graphics are AI slop. The books themselves are written AI slop. Sometimes they have synthesized voice for talking books that are slop. It's sort of amazing the amount of slop that's all around us. All the thumbnails, as you mentioned, for YouTube are generated by AI. And that's almost 95%, it seems, at this point. But even worse than that, you know, I could suffer through a thumbnail graphic. What bothers me a great deal is I'll see something interesting, and I'll click it, and I'll hear a synthesized voice. Then I'll see a bunch of pseudo-illustrations that have very little to do with the underlying story that's being told. The story is kind of very strangely non-human, so it's probably generated by AI. And sometimes the outline even is generated by AI. So there are grifters out there that are promoting that they're going to teach you how to do all this. You go to one AI and you ask it to make up a plot. You go to another AI and you tell it to make up the content. You go to another one for the graphics and another one for the voice. So we're inundated by AI slop today, and it's only going to get worse, unfortunately, especially as the inputs are slop themselves, because it's inevitable, because none of this thing is tagged. You know, there should be a law that you tag these things. If it's AI, it should have some kind of ability to indicate that it's AI. But because there's no such thing, they're refeeding all this regurgitated nonsense into the programming of the next generation of these artificial intelligence, air quotes. So it's going to get worse. I hate to tell you that, but it's going to get definitely worse.
Interesting commentary. It was crazy that in the first couple of seconds of what you were saying, I was like, it sounds exactly like mad cow disease.
Well, who knows? It depends on how imaginative people are going to be about as AI gets weirder and weirder. Most likely, unfortunately, they're going to ask AI to come up with a memorable term for it. So, you know, who knows what that would be.
So I'm wondering, the whole thing is so recognizable by anybody that's thinking and looks at it and goes, is that real? And when they start making these weird, it's funny, maybe the English language would be our savior, because the oddities of the English language take a lot of mental acuity to make the language function. And AI seems to stumble on that completely. And when they say some odd things, you go, that's not a person.
Yeah, but, you know, the true believers, because this is kind of turning into a cult. We have a lot of different cults running around simultaneously these days, and artificial intelligence is getting a little culty too. And, you know, if you talk to these guys who are somewhat in the know on the subject, they'll say, well, it's only going to get better. So, I mean, nowadays some people can detect it, and you'd be surprised. There are a bunch of people who don't really perceive anything in this life, so don't perceive that it's artificial either. These cultists don't factor into my problem with the Internet being fed into itself, so... You know, that's going to make it worse, but they don't seem to believe that. They think that somehow there'd be a relatively AI-sterile source for input to train these AIs. I don't see how. So they'll come up and they'll say, well, it'll only get better. Plus, As the technology it gets more and more sophisticated, we'll soon have a pure general artificial intelligence, which is not the same as large language models and generative AI. And then eventually we'll have a super genius, the second coming will come, will arrive. So cultists will never give up. They will always predict a great future, you know, no matter what you explain to them. It's far easier to fool a person than to convince a person that they've been fooled.
Well, we come full circle to that. I like your idea about labeling. If there's a red dye number 99 in my Twizzlers, I would like it to be on a label. I think there should be a similar thing on AI. I like your idea on that.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's such a diffuse field that there's no particular agency that kind of manages that. You would probably have to go to governmental regulatory agencies. And unfortunately, this is not the season for regulation. So I would not suggest anyone hold their breath for anything like that. You know, I'm waiting for the EU to do it, because the EU tends to be a lot better at regulating things. You know, they were the ones who brought us the old cell phones. You have to be able to change the damn batteries on a cell phone without an $80 labor charge. So I'm hoping and expecting the EU to be the first people to kind of require by law that everything be labeled if it's generated in any way, shape, or form using artificial intelligence. So the only problem with that is almost every source will be labeled, because at least the thumbnail is going to be AI. It's very difficult to get people to stop doing that now. It's just so easy. And they seem to feel that it gives them more clicks, and that's the only reason they're there on YouTube these days, is to make AdSense.
All interesting commentary, but at risk of wearing it out, I'll move on. I think we are in unusually close agreement on this topic, Roy.
Well, if I remember, we pretty much agreed with a lot of things last week. So, you know, maybe something special has happened. You know, I got to check my astrology book.
Okay, so I'll go to a dipole question, if that's all right.
Sure.
So after much prognostication and delays, I actually have about 200 feet of rope up in the air, halyard style. I can put a dipole up and down instantaneously. I got the whole mechanical thing squared away for the linked dipole that I've been imagining in my head for years now. You've heard me ask about it. And I got a 20-meter section right now of wire up there. So I did pretty good on 20 meters. I got to Russia and Italy and Washington State. So it works. So what I'm looking to do is target 40 meters, 60 meters, 80 meters. And I learned the other day, and I'm looking for some corroboration or knock it down, that if you take a 40-meter dipole, which will be the heart of this thing, a 40-meter dipole with extensions through the other bands, and you tune it to the lower frequency portion of the band, that gives you that should give you the ability to utilize the resonance of 20 meters on the 40-meter dipole more easily. It's a very general statement, I know, but any commentary on that topic from yourself or others?
Well, I think you have to describe it a little bit better. You say you have a 40-meter centifed dipole, and you're going to tune it. You have to explain what you mean by you're going to tune it for 20 meters.
I suppose, well, right now it's a 20 meter. I'm going to take that down. I have the ropes set up that I can run almost 200 foot of antenna. I just have to click it onto the ropes and pull it up like a flagpole. So the mechanical is all done. What's hanging up there now is a 20 meter dipole. That's going to come down, and it's going to be a 40 meter put up. And I was thinking of tuning it in the middle of the 40 meter band. And then I got a recommendation that tune it at the lower end of the 40-meter band, and you also able to get 20 meters on that 40-meter dipole because it'll be resonant. I think that's the core of the thought.
Only be too huge. Hello?
Yes?
Okay, his name is Bill. Happened to be in the truck this evening. The net was on, so here I am. So, my 2 cents, and that is absolutely all it is. With the space that you have up there, you could easily hang an off-center fed dipole, which is going to work, in my opinion, great on 40, great on 20, and with a tuner, an external tuner like an LDG, not a internal tuner in the radio, will give you good performance on 60. Plus, you'll get a halfway decent antenna on 80 and 10 and the warp bands. 15 is a little bit of a toss-up, but that's a pretty good solution. Now, I'll tell you that I did compare that antenna extensively to a G5RV on 20 and 40, and the off-center fed dipole outperformed the G5, significantly noticeably. So that's my suggestion.
Thank you, Bill. Jim, I don't know where you got that, but a center-fed dipole, no matter whether you tune it to the middle of the band, to one end of the band, or the other end of the band, it tends to be somewhat awful when it comes to half the wavelength, going from 40 to 20, because instead of being a quarter wavelength, it's now half wavelength on each of the dipoles, and the impedance goes up to close to infinity, but really something around 2,000 or 3,000, and so that's something that a regular antenna tuner is going to have some problem tuning, which is why when people do the NFED thing, they usually have a 49 or a 64 to 1 balance to take care of most of the impedance that half wavelength elements kind of produce. But as Bill mentioned, if you make an off center dipole, you can hope to get harmonics from the other band. So I would agree with him, among other different ways of handling it, that an off-center fed is probably a much better chance to get harmonics and the other bands in the amateur radio frequency. But you can't really just adjust where it's tuned to on one band if with a center fed. It would not give you really good tuning.
Interesting feedback. You'll grin to know that Bill is a step ahead of my discussion. I've been thinking about the same thing that he is. And as much as my end goal is a 80-meter dipole that has links so I can take it down from an 80-meter dipole to a 60-meter dipole to a 40-meter dipole. So the first thing I got to do is put up the 40-meter, tune it where I want it, and then add the 60 and the 80. When I do that, I believe I'm going to wind up with an antenna that has the ability to be fed through one of the link points as an off-center fed dipole at 80-20 ratio, which gives me a very good wide-banded operation, I think, and the ability to use a tuner to go all over the place. But I also like to retain the ability to feed it in the other places. Basically, I'm creating the links in the center point, center device are going to be the same, and I can either feed it or link it at any of the spots that are linked. That's where I'm actually heading.
Maybe two QGs.
Yep. Yeah, Bill?
Okay. My understanding is the off-center fed balun is a 4-to-1, where there's either a 1-to-1 or no balun required on the regular dipole, regular, you know, half-wave dipole. Now, that's the thing. If you're going to take it down and mix and match and make it, you know, adjust it per band, you can do that. What I'll tell you is I use that off-center fed dipole from about 3 megahertz to, honestly, up to 10, but on all sorts of non-resonant frequencies for a Mars thing. And it just works really well everywhere without me having to do anything, right? So if you want to, you know, adjust per band, you'll probably get better performance, and you might be better off with a which is a dipole per band. But what I'll tell you, a bunch of other guys use who also need to operate on non-resonant channels is just a fan dipole. I mean, you know, for 3 megahertz, 4 megahertz, 6 megahertz, you know. Three fan dipoles work, you know, really good and are relatively broadband on those center cut frequencies.
Yeah, Bill, I agree. I used to use a fan dipole. I like them a lot. They require a little bit of work. Most antennas actually need a little bit of work because the coupling between the elements will detune them, so you have to kind of adjust the length in place. You can't kind of do it on the ground and then assume that it's going to stay to be the same thing up in the air. But yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of different permutations. You could have swappable dipoles. You could have off-center fed with a 4-to-1 balance. That's the problem. If you're going to kind of reinvent the wheel and you're going to develop a series of antennas that are just off-center and, you know, fed, you probably should consider the impedances that differ, because the way that a center-fed dipole works is that the center feed is the lowest possible impedance, about 50 ohms, give or take. And as you go off from the center, the antenna feed impedance goes up. So for a off-center fed, usually that's why you use a 4-to-1, because the impedance goes from 50 to about 200. And as you get closer and closer to the edges, the impedances rise higher and higher until they reach something like 2 to 1,000. So you could have different balance. You could have different feed points. You could, you know, I really like fan dipoles personally, but, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat.
So it's interesting that what I'm trying to do is have as unobtrusive an aerial up in the air as possible. And right now it is. It's like I said, it's almost 200 feet long, and it's mostly rope. There's only a 20-meter dipole hanging in that 200 feet of power cord on one side and bank line on the other side. I can have a party underneath it. Nobody knows it's there. It just disappears into the trees and the sky. And I can drop it down easily as dropping a flag on a flagpole. Connect my feed point any place, any of the links, pull it back up again in a matter of less than a minute, and do whatever. So mechanically, I think I've jumped the shark and got way ahead of a lot of folks. Electrically, I'm a noob walking around in the dark.
K2SDP.
Yes, Chris?
Jim, just a quick question. Are you doing this because you want to build the antenna, invent the antenna kind of thing, to have some fun, or are you trying to get a multi-band antenna easily up and down?
I'm trying to put up a easily frequency agile antenna that doesn't upset the fairer types. And I'm not a big believer that antennas have to be so obvious. I got this thing up in the air that right now it's most of that 200-foot length is rope that's 2 to 3 times bigger than the antenna wire that will be up there. And it's literally invisible. Just why you buy questions from the wife or the neighbors.
Okay, so I would suggest an NFED antenna, a multi-band NFED antenna. So they have, for example, I have a 129-foot piece of wire. It's got a 49-to-1 bound on the end. And I can tune up and talk on pretty much any band, 180 all the way up. 180 is a little, 160, a little tricky, but 80 meters up is fantastic. It's under 2-to-1 on every band. Antenna, internal antenna tuner takes care of it, and I also have an external one, which is even better. But you can get one pre-made for $200, probably even less, and put it up. You'll never have to take it up or down or do anything but hit the tune button, K2STP.
Yeah, Chris is right. I mean, there's a lot of multi-band options available that don't necessarily require multiple times, pulling your antenna up and down. It's always a good feature, and in the end, it'll save you probably a lot of grief. But, you don't want to kind of do that repeatedly in one session if you can spare yourself it. And Bill and Chris said, there are a slew of multi-band designs. The efficiency of an NFED is not terribly good because it does require a significant balun, a 64 or 48-to-1. Those things are kind of intrinsically inefficient, so you will have some loss in the transformation of the impedance, but you will get the ability to get to a lot of ham bands on the same construction. Those are good options as well.
I agree. That was in my calculations also, right? 1-to-1 balun and a 4-to-1 balun, so I can use it as center fed or off center fed. I don't have anything to feed it with an end fed, but there's no reason why I couldn't do that. And the way I have it rigged, it's just literally so easy. Like a camp cleat, I just kind of flick it off. The antenna lowers down to about 5 feet high, connect where I want to, pull it back up again. It's ridiculously easy. And if I connect it at that 80-20 spot for the feed, basically I have it set up as like a link dipole, but you can feed it at any one of the links. And it's way simpler than most. Everybody usually thinks of the center of the center device at a dipole as kind of a construction. I've just eliminated that entirely, and I can just clip on with a tiny little plastic carabiner to any of the links and feed it wherever I want.
Okay, again, that certainly is an option. I think most hams would prefer a design that just was inherently multi-band from the get-go, so you don't have to deal with the ups and downs. It might be a fun to play around with the mechanism at first, but after a while, and if the weather changed, you kind of would prefer to have an antenna that was operational on multiple bands without any kind of physical modifications. But it's your antenna, and you could do all kinds of interesting experiments to see if you could shift the mode that it's resonant for that frequency, and then get a rough approximation of how far your signal goes and how far you're able to make contacts, and come up with some new interesting information to share with everyone.
Well, that's the goal. Thanks for exploring the topic with me. Back to that. Thank you, Roy.
Okey-doke. Good luck, and come back and tell us how it's working out for you. I'm sure you will, but I just thought I'd throw that in. That'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to find out different modes you've chosen to use and what results you've gotten with them.
I was kind of shocked when I talked to Ridley in Washington State on this cruddy little thingy that I put up. It was not specifically tuned. I have a tuner, it works. And that was not my goal at all. That just happened to what people went up.
Yeah, well, stuff is very unpredictable. You don't really know how good an antenna is. You know, you can simulate it with software, and you can pontificate, but push comes to shove. When you hit that transmitter and listen for the signal that elicits it, who knows? It could be anything. I mean, Dick K2IW, may rest in peace, he used to regularly talk about a ham in the local that had an antenna that was sitting on the ground, which not terribly good for an antenna. And yet that guy made a lot of contacts with that strange little antenna of his. So you never know until you try it out.
I'm very intrigued by the ground-mounted antenna, specifically for receive. Very interesting concepts. I think it has merit for certain applications.
Yeah, but usually it requires a significant amount of real estate because it's a receive only. It's not a standing wave. It's a traveling wave usually. And in order to get the most bang for the buck, you have to make it relatively long. If you make those things too short, they all end in a non-inductive resistive load. So the shorter your traveling wave antenna is, the more will be wasted as thermal heat. But, yeah, those are fascinating types of antennas. Some hams use them. A lot of hams use primarily standing wave, where resonance is important. Traveling wave, you don't have to worry too much about resonance because it's just taking a one-way trip. It doesn't have to bounce back and forth repeatedly.
I have not heard the concept of a traveling wave antenna before. Can you explain?
Yes, indeed. The usual type of antenna amateur radio use are called standing wave antennas, and what they are, the wave that you're creating in your transmitter and sending in through your coax, the transmission line, goes to the antenna, reaches the end, and then bounces back. It reaches the feed point, it bounces back, and so you have a resonant oscillating RF wave that goes back and forth and back and forth, and as it reflects back and forth, some of it is transferred into radio waves, what we call a radiation resistance, and that's what you want to have happen. It radiates and your signal goes out. Traveling waves just go in one direction. They don't bounce back. You don't need to worry about resonance because you don't want them to be in sync going back and forth. They're not. They're going all the way to the end, and then a small non-inductive resist load is quenching that radio wave, that pulse of the radio wave, into thermal heat. So you're hoping and betting that most of the length of the traveling wave wire is either going to radiate energy, but more important, these things tend to be used more often as a receiving antenna. So it's a long length of wire with a terminating resistance, and the longer, the better it will function. You don't have to sit around and worry about wavelengths and what length is its optimum. There's no real such thing as an optimal length. It's just the longer, the better.
Well, I can't say I get the concept, but I recognize that these things take hearing the concept a few different times from a few different people and reading about it and thinking about it. And I'm not there yet. But thanks for trying. Back to that.
Okay, Jim. Just if you have nothing better to do one night, Google beverage antenna. It's not named after the beverage. It's named after a guy whose last name was Beverage. And that's a traveling wave antenna that's very popular among, very low frequency type of guys as a receiving antenna. So check it out when you have a chance.
I'm familiar with the term, but understanding how it works eludes me.
Okay, I'm sure you can find a YouTube or, you know, just a page to describe it. Like I said, of all the type of traveling wave antennas, that's probably the most popular among amateur radio operators. Yes?
I'll tell him to also look up Rhombic.
Okay, yeah.
Take that, I'll look at the Rhombic.
Okay, very good. Anyone with any other comments about this topic? Otherwise, we'll move on.
WA2CXR.
Yes, what can I do you for?
Not being a fan of having to go outside to tune an antenna, I heard some guys on any media talking, and what I ended up modifying was with 200 feet, you can get a non-resonant doublet up there, maybe 112 feet, 114 feet, anything that's not going to be resonant on any amateur band, and then get a good spool of number 14 wire and make your own ladder line. You can buy the spacers and then put it into a ballon, and it comes in the house as a piece of coax. Good tuner. I have a PAL Star. Mine tunes from 6 meters to 160, and it's all the whole band of each band, just about a 201 or less. It works great. I don't have to run out there to marvel at it.
Yeah, that's yet another choice that some people make. I don't think quite that many. I think, unfortunately, people have very little experience these days with open lines. A lot of times, rather than do it quite that way, what they might decide to do is to throw a little bit more money at it and get a external weatherproofed antenna tuner at the feed point, and then run coax from that point into the shack. But yeah, if you feel comfy with open line, sure, that's another method.
Back, what amazed me is that I could tune it from 50 megahertz to 1.9 megahertz. It's a pretty large range for a dumb antenna, a simple antenna. It's a little tedious putting the spacers on. The trick is not to have a resonant antenna up there. The doublet, each half of the doublet has to be a non-resonant length. So, you know how to figure out what is resonant and go in between. And you want to drop the ladder line at least the length of the lowest frequency. It come down vertically as much as possible. And I did not want to have to bring that through the house, so I hung the ballon up under the eaves. It comes in as coax. I'm sounding like it was not a big deal. At the time, it was a big deal to make all this because it was a ton of measuring, but it worked. It worked very well for, I don't know, it was less than $100 for those. I doubt it's been even that much for the wire.
Yeah, it'll work. You have to keep the length of the coax relatively short because that's where there's going to be a lot of attenuation loss. But, you know, if you keep it short, that's fine. So again, some people who don't feel that comfortable of making their own open line, they're not terribly expensive. It's not as easy to find them. I think there's a guy called the Wire Guy, and there's some other companies that retail open line type of wires. But yeah, it's all doable. Anyway, I think we kind of beat that horse. He's not dead by far. There's a lot of good designs for multi-band antennas out there that have different pluses and minuses. And no doubt we will come back to this subject again many times on the Technical Net. Alex, what can I do you for tonight?
pretty quick. Given the weather, I parked my car outside, and I'm running the mobile radio off a 100-amp-hour lithium iron phosphate battery. When do I have to worry about the heat inside of the car? In days where it gets above 90, I've been running down and taking the battery out. And if it's bad for the battery, is it because it's going to light on fire, or is it the temperature? I think you're going to tell me that the temperature change in the battery will shorten the lifespan of a lithium iron phosphate battery. 82 to you.
Yeah, you did the question, you did the answer. Yeah, the big problem is temperature isn't good in general. Yeah, I mean, does it increase the possibilities of a runaway thermal a problem that's going to cause a lot of heartache? Possibly, but it's very... But in general, you don't want to overheat batteries. Batteries are chemicals. It's an oxidative reductive reaction. You know, the same way that a butane tank and oxygen from the air produces a redox, except that instead of going directly to thermal heat, it put the electron transfers to work for us, so that we force the electrons not to rearrange themselves in the electrolytes, but to go through the cathode and the anode to an outside circuit and run stuff for us. But heat will just deteriorate the anodes and the cathodes kind of universally. I know of no battery that's relatively heat-proof. Heat is always a problem. Some are a little bit easy to deal with than others. But the primary thing is you're going to age your rechargeable battery prematurely. You will find that its energy carrying capacity will diminish, its recycle numbers will diminish, and just it will be a far less effective rechargeable battery. So that's why everyone kind of explains to each other that you really should be mindful of leaving it in place like a closed, unventilated car on a sunny day.
Makes sense. I'll start removing it. My second follow-up is also, I think, very quick. I need to buy better alligator clamps for that battery, and I also need one screw for the belt loop on my Kenwood handheld. Where do you buy these days, like, small numbers of either a screw, alligator clips? Like, there's not a Radio Shack anymore. Where are you buying this stuff?
Well, that's a good question. Unfortunately, I don't have a great answer for it. Some of these things you might be able to get at Home Depot. A lot of these things I know you can get at Amazon, but the problem with Amazon is they're basically a front end for Chinese manufacturers. Chinese manufacturers tend to not risk building good quality, expensive stuff. They tend to go cheap. They cut all the angles that they can. So it would be nice if there was an Amazon store that you could kind of go in and get a good feel of how heavy it is and whether it looks like it's just plated and some really cheap metal underneath and not. You got to have to play Russian roulette with Amazon. You have to play a lot bigger Russian roulette with eBay, so I wouldn't recommend that. So those would be the two that I would recommend. Of course, there are much more expensive commercial companies that tend to make most of their money, I think, selling discrete components, and they probably have other bits and pieces that go together with electrical circuits. So, you know, you could Google those types of, distribution centers. Again, you're dealing with the web, so you're not going to be able to visualize any of these products. You'll take either a terrible picture or just a drawing. If anyone else out there has any good sources for this type of stuff, please let Alex know.
How big an alligator clip are you looking for? This is W-A-2-C-X-R.
I think whatever the right size to clamp on and off to a 100 amp hour battery, so where there's battery terminal screws exposed, but I want to do it with an alligator clip versus an O-ring connector, I don't know the name of it, because if I'm popping it out of the car to recharge it all the time, I'm just too lazy to wire the radio into the actual car. And also, I like it to be removable so it doesn't get stolen in Queens.
What about banana plugs?
That probably works, but would you, if you're going from a battery, how do you get a banana plug? I guess I don't know where you'd put the banana plugs in this scenario.
You can get a clampable O-ring that ends in a banana plug type of connection, a socket, if you will, that just happens to be bent to the right shape that it fits the banana plug.
Got it. So I could just leave the O-ring on the battery and then banana plug in and out the wire and just carry the battery out with the wire on it?
Yes, exactly.
Interesting. I'll take a look at that. I'm assuming I'll like find one on DX Engineer. Somebody's got to sell that and then check out the hardware store. I hadn't thought of Home Depot. I don't know. It seems super obvious. But that sounds like a good recommendation, at least to find the little mini screw. ADTDU.
Yeah, and you might want to just rummage through Amazon. Even if you decide not to go through them, it'll give you a better perspective of what kind of adapters are available, what size and shape they are. Because you got, of course, you want to get an O-ring that fits the screw. Otherwise, that would be rather problematic. But yeah, you could try any of those places. I'm not quite sure if DX Engineering has lugs or such. They might. I haven't really looked for lugs there. I've done a lot of rummaging through Amazon for different types of lugs in the past.
Yeah, I have a long and storied history of buying things the wrong size but in the correct proportion from the internet. I bought it like a 2 foot tall shovel one time. So I'm wary of not being able to gauge the real size. But we'll see. Thank you for the information, right? Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform.
Okay, very good, Alex. I wish you good luck, and if you have the opportunity to come back and tell us what you finally decided on and whether it worked for you, we're always looking for these bits of the story type of thing. We usually only hear the beginning part, so I wish you luck.
Yeah, will do. Because I got to figure this out. I'm moving to a long commute, so we got to get the radio in tip-top shape. Thanks for your help, Rick.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for participating in the technical mix. Let me just call out to everyone out there. Maybe in the 55 minutes, some people arrived late. If you want to put your name on the list tonight for questions, topics, comments, what have you, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name, your call sign, and whether it's science, technology, or amateur radio.
Kilo Echo 2 Charlie Alpha Bravo. Hello to all. My name is Andreas, Kingdom Falls, New Jersey. I got a couple of questions for you. I'm new into this. Probably my question's going to sound stupid, but anyway, back to you.
Okay, Andreas, there's no such thing as a stupid question, like I said the other night. We all started from square one and had to learn everything that we knew. None of us are born with this information. Once again, Wesley, do you mind if I take Andreas first before you?
Please go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, Andreas, what's your first one?
Okay, radio test, sound test. How does it sound? I just put a new antenna. I grounded it. I put it through a lightning surge protector. I wonder if I did everything right. How does it sound to you? Is there room for improvement on the quality of the audio?
Well, yeah, your audio is rather low. It's not incredibly low, but it is rather low. And there are background audio artifacts. Like, it's not noise. It's not random hissing. But there is some strange audio artifact, and because your audio is relatively low, it kind of reinforces that background noise. Of I can't tell you exactly right now what its origin might be.
Okay, so here's a question. I've been looking into a 2-meter tuner, MFJ1, available on eBay for 2 meters and 70 centimeters. What do you think about those?
Not a hell of a lot. I have one. I play around with it a little bit. I didn't find anything useful. Most, especially commercial 2-meter, 70-centimeter antennas are reasonably resonant on the frequencies that we use. Most people tend to stay in the repeater FM zone. So I can't think off the top of my head of anyone who actually has needed to use a tuner for their antennas. So, you know, it's a nice thing to diddle and play with, but I kind of, when I first was starting out, I couldn't locate my antenna in any kind of a decent area. Elevation is the most important thing, and mine was about 6 feet off the ground, which was not good. And I tried all kinds of tricks to game the laws of physics. I tried antenna tuners, I tried linear amplifiers, and none of them was really a satisfactory solution. I just had to lift the damn antenna over my roof. And then magic happened. So I'm not a big fan unless you have to know that the antenna that you must use is very off-resonant for some reason and giving you a really bad SWR. Again, not usually the case. Most people can have a slight mismatch and not have any problems getting into feeders of their choice. So unless you have a definitive standing wave ratio problem, I don't think it's worth the money, personally.
Okay, I get an SWR on this repeater of 1.1 because I just bought this SWR power meter. You know, on some other, I think I talked to you the other day, on some other repeaters I get up to 2, the SWR. But now talking to you, I see 1.1. Now, the antenna, I just put a new antenna, Diamond X-510 HDM, which is put up to 310 watts. It's 20 feet off the ground and 17 feet the antenna. It's about 40, the top of it is about 40 feet off the ground in New Jersey. So I wonder why you say the radio, the quality of the audio doesn't come through good. Back to you.
Well, there's a lot more to life than standing wave ratio, and we've discussed this on the technical net probably for 44 years. That the reason why everyone is so concerned with their standing wave ratio is because it's actually something that you could measure. There are a lot more important things that we can't measure, so we don't worry about them. There's no such thing as an efficiency meter, so we can't tell you how many of the watts that you're putting in from your transmitter is actually being radiated by your antenna. In some cases, efficiencies of some antennas are 3 or 4%. So you could be throwing 100 watts in your transmission line and really putting out about 2, 3 watts of radio waves. Because, again, there's no such thing as an efficiency meter. People are more than happy to do that. It comes to basically how well you can get out and reach the repeaters. And again, noise is not totally a function of your standing wave ratio. It's partially the standing wave ratio because as the standing wave ratio gets worse and worse, you have reflections of your signal going back to your shack, and so some of your energy never...